It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting a U.S. warning to Russia about Syrian airstrikes. The White House says Russia has further isolated itself by carrying out airstrikes in Syria and is putting itself in jeopardy. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says Russian interference would prolong the sectarian conflict inside of Syria and accuse Russia of conducting indiscriminate military operations against Syrian opposition groups, some of whom are allied to the United States. The U.S. and Russian militaries held a teleconference Thursday on ways they can avoid firing on each other as both wage war campaigns in Syria. A Pentagon spokesman described the hour-long conversation Thursday as cordial, with more such meetings expected in the coming days. At least 10 people were killed and 7 wounded in a shooting Thursday at a small community college in the northwest U.S. city of Roseburg, Oregon. The gunman was killed in a police shootout. Law enforcement officials have identified him as 26-year-old Chris Harper Mercer. Authorities believe he was familiar with the Umpqua Community College campus. A few hours after the shootings, a visibly angry President Obama spoke at the White House, demanding the American people push Congress to pass what he called common-sense gun laws. Mr. Obama said Americans have become numb to what has become routine in the U.S., a mass shooting followed by his White House statements and the response by those who oppose more gun control. The general behind last month's failed coup in Burkina Faso surrendered to the country's transitional government. General Gilbert Diendéré turned himself in Thursday after negotiations with officials in the capital, Ouagadougou. Reports, according to the VOA French to Africa service, say he received assurances he'd not be killed. This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the UN General Assembly Thursday, telling those nations who had spoken out in favor of the Iran nuclear deal, in his words, "Check your enthusiasm at the door." Prime Minister Netanyahu said that by giving Iran billions of dollars in sanctions relief, the deal makes war more likely.
70 years after the murder of 6 million Jews, Iran's rulers promised to destroy my country, murder my people. And the response from this body, the response from nearly every one of the governments represented here, has been absolutely nothing. Utter silence. Deafening silence.
Prime Minister Netanyahu also condemned Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas's speech Wednesday as rejectionism of the peace process. Mr. Netanyahu said he is prepared to immediately resume direct negotiations with the Palestinian Authority without preconditions. Israeli authorities say an Israeli mother and father were shot dead Thursday in an attack on their vehicle by suspected Palestinian militants in the northern West Bank. The couple from the Jewish settlement of Neria leaves behind 6 orphan children. 4 of the children, aged 4 months, 4 years old, 7 and 9, were in the vehicle at the time of the attack. They were slightly wounded. Israeli security services are hunting for the perpetrators. An American C-130 military transport plane crashed at Jalalabad Airport in eastern Afghanistan, killing 11 people. The crash occurred shortly after midnight local time Friday. The cause of the accident is under investigation. U.S. defense officials at Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan say 6 U.S. service members who comprised the plane's crew died, along with 5 civilian passengers. The foundations of the European Union are being rocked this year by the political chaos sparked by Greece's economic woes and the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees. Some analysts say the European Union itself now faces an existential threat. Henry Ridgewell reports.
30 years ago, 5 EU states signed the Schengen Agreement that created a passport-free travel zone, which has since expanded across 26 European states. But that core EU principle of freedom of movement is being tested as several countries reintroduce border checks to counter the migrant surge. Hungary has built razor wire fences along its southern borders. On the horizon lie yet more threats. Britain will hold a vote on leaving the EU before 2018, with recent opinion polls favouring an exit. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the second day of October. And here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan appeals for international aid to help implement the latest peace agreement.
More than any other time in our conflict-riddled history, the upcoming post-conflict imperatives of resettlement, rehabilitation, and disarmament require concerted financial and technical intervention.
James Wani Iga is South Sudan's vice president. Central African Republic considers delaying its October 18th elections amid renewed violence. Burkina Faso's labor unions want justice now that failed coup leader Gilbert Diendere has surrendered to police. And President Buhari asks Nigerians to change their behavior.
You can't be unruly and want an orderly society. You can't be corrupt and want to see a corrupt-free country. You can't be a fraudulent person and expect to see a country where integrity rules and reigns.
Femi Adesina is special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammad Buhari. The scars of LRA brutality are still being felt in Uganda, and South Africa's most famous comedian takes over an American late-night television show. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan Vice President James Wani Iga says his country is determined to correct the past and looks forward to the future, which he said is full of hope. Speaking Thursday at the ongoing 70th session of the UN General Assembly, Wani Iga proclaimed an end to the country's year-long civil war.
Your Excellencies, it is my pleasure and relief to announce to you and this August gathering that this regrettable war and uncalled for bloodshed has been ended. The people of South Sudan were yearning for peace, and our president took the courageous step with the help of IGAD, the Troika, China, Russia, and the eminent United Nations, and so on, to sign on 26th of August 2015 a peace agreement with our brothers in the rebellion to silence the guns and end the civil war. This signature was immediately followed by the president's declaration of permanent ceasefire in the following day.
The vice president appealed to the international community to provide the necessary financial assistance to help implement the latest peace agreement.
There is no doubt that development and prosperity can quickly lead to cementing peace and stability. It is thus mandatory upon the government of South Sudan to remind the international donors about the many pledges they have made even earlier but never delivered. More than any other time in our conflict-riddled history, the upcoming post-conflict imperatives of resettlement, rehabilitation, and disarmament require concerted financial and technical intervention from many of our friends of goodwill around the world. Honoring the numerous pledges will go a long way in enabling the full implementation of the current peace agreement in terms of meeting a pressing need for humanitarian aid and post-conflict reconstruction.
The United Nations reported last year that both sides in the South Sudan conflict violated international human rights and humanitarian law, including extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances, rape and other acts of sexual violence, arbitrary arrests and detention. But Wani Iga says the South Sudan government adheres to international human rights laws.
Committing crimes against the people we govern or violations of human rights have never and shall never be condoned by our government. We are conscious of our obligation to humanity and do respect human rights charter as contained in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and related protocols. We respect the content and provisions of the Geneva Conventions, and we vow to faithfully observe and apply them in our difficult and complex context. Since our independence, whenever we receive reports of human rights abuses by elements associated with our security institutions, we have obtained, investigated, and immediately dealt with them in accordance with the law.
That was South Sudan Vice President James Mwani Iga speaking Thursday at the ongoing 70th session of the UN General Assembly in New York. A fresh wave of violence in the capital of the Central African Republic has killed at least 36 people and displaced 30,000 people. The top question now is whether the Central African Republic will push back the October 18 elections to later this year. Katerina Hoyer reports from Bamako.
Transitional authorities in Dakar had been warning of an election delay even before a new wave of violence began last Friday. France is against the postponement, while the UN is calling for polls by the end of the year. International Crisis Group analyst Thibault Lesser says a vote under current conditions is unrealistic and would only add fuel to the fire with the risk of increasing tensions.
Well, if elections are organized now, I think the risk is also the acceptance of the armed groups of the electoral process. So they will, of course, try to disturb this process. So the population won't be able to vote freely and again in a safe environment.
The fighting was triggered by the killing of a motorcycle taxi driver in Bangui's mostly Muslim neighborhood of PK5. Muslims sought revenge against Christians in other neighborhoods.
Last event in Bangui, they got traumatic event in Bangui, but it shows very clearly that intercommunal tensions are still very strong there. And not only in the center of the country, but also in the capital city. It happens in a specific political sequence because there's elections to be organized only at the end of the year, at the end of 2015. So, of course, it's a way for some armed groups leader to try to put a pressure on the authorities and try to enter in kind of a political bargaining with them.
With more than 360,000 people displaced within Dakar, polls will be a logistical challenge. Nearly 500,000, most of them Muslims, are refugees in neighboring countries. Remy Jemus, a local journalist and human rights activist, says that for elections to be credible, people need to be able to vote. Politicians need to be able to campaign. This is not possible as many areas are still controlled by armed groups. Transitional authorities, together with 12,000 UN peacekeepers and 1,000 French troops, have struggled to calm tensions over the past year, and it is unclear what more could be done in the months ahead as disarmament efforts have stalled. The ex-Leka rebels, who ousted former President François Bozize in 2013, still control territory, primarily in the north. They called for reinforcements in Bangui this week, as anti-Balaka there began rallying fighters from around the country. Interim President Catherine Samba Panza blames Bozize and other politicians for rallying the militias, accusing them of an attempted coup. The armed groups have little interest in changing the status quo. Analysts predict tensions will remain high at least until polls are held. This is Katerina Hoye for VOA News in Bamako.
The leader and chief negotiator for the Confederation of Labor Unions in Burkina Faso says the Burkinabe people want justice now that the leader of last month's failed coup has surrendered to authorities. General Gilbert Diendere turned himself in on Thursday after negotiations with officials in the capital, Ouagadougou. VOA's French to Africa service reports that Diendere received assurances that he would not be killed and that he and other soldiers who took part in the September 16 coup will receive a fair trial. Labor unions leader Bazie Basoma says the people want justice because General Diendere's hands have been found in many problems affecting Burkina Faso.
Yes, we are happy for that because we are fight always to get justice. If he had good many things, who is very bad for our people, it is normally to go and answer in front of justice.
What kind of justice do you want?
There are many, 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 many things. First, it is we have found his name in many, many, many problems in our country. So in this moment also we know that there are many bodies in our hospital. So if we have not got time to try for justice, it is not a good moment for our people.
You said you found Diendere's name in many areas in your country. There are some who have said that he might have had something to do with the death of Thomas Sankara. Is that one of the things you're talking about?
Yes, it is not only Thomas Sankara. There are Thomas Sankara, Dabo Bukari in Liberia, so on Angola. Many problems. His name is found there.
Are you saying the Dere was in Liberia?
Yes.
He was there doing what? Peacekeeper or what?
Yes, pupil.
So he might have something to do with what took place in Liberia.
You know that sometimes there are a war in Liberia.
Yes, I know.
And Charles Taylor.
So for now, your people are happy. The civil society, the labor unions, they're happy the fact that Diendere has turned himself in. You are happy about that.
Yes. Our people is very, very, very happy.
Do you know anything about when the election will take place?
No, but you know, our solution for our problem is not in election. If we are not organized, good. If we are not mobilized more, it is difficult to find more solution for our problems.
Is there something that you think other African countries can learn from the way the civil society behaved in Burkina Faso?
The first thing is to talk more for our brothers in other country who help us in this difficult situation. We are fighting for this democracy in Burkina, but also for Africa and in this world. It is not only the problem in Burkina Faso. Our fighting is for democracy for our countries in our world.
Bazir Bassoma is the leader and chief negotiator for Burkina Faso's labor unions. He was speaking with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, the second day of October. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brela FM in Nigeria and Kisi FM in Tanzania. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. A spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has been giving explanation on what exactly the president meant when he called for an end to unruly behavior in Nigeria. In his first Independence Day speech to the nation Thursday, President Buhari said change cannot happen without a change in citizens' behavior. Femi Adesina is special advisor on media and publicity to President Buhari. He said the president is a Democrat and is not trying to introduce a military-style discipline in Nigeria.
What the president was trying to say was that Nigerians should be part of the change they expect to see in the country. You can't be unruly and want an orderly society. You can't be corrupt and want to see a corrupt-free country. You can't be a fraudulent person and expect to see a country where integrity rules and reigns. So be part of the change you wish to see in the country.
So it doesn't mean, because some people are suggesting that the president is trying to inject military discipline in our...
No, this is a democracy, and the president is a Democrat. No, anybody that infers that has not read the president right.
So the president has said that he has submitted the names of his new cabinet to the parliament. He said yesterday that he probably wants to take over the oil. How is he going to do that?
No, he has said it. It's not the first time it will be happening in the country. We've had a president who manned the oil industry himself. He didn't appoint an oil minister. That was President Obasanjo. So it's not the first time it's happening.
If he is the president, that's a very big responsibility.
Sure, but he has the requisite experience, having been oil minister for 3.5 years in the past.
Why did it take this long for the president to name a cabinet?
He explained it in the national broadcast that came in today. Said he needed to set some things in order. He needed to know how many ministries we will have in the first place. What's the essence of appointing ministers when you have not decided the number of ministries you are going to have?
Is it possible we can see streamlining of the Nigerian cabinet, that we might have a smaller cabinet now?
It's not unlikely, but what you should realize is that the Nigerian constitution also makes it imperative that there must be one minister per state.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Earlier this year, the Ugandan government extended a law giving amnesty to former rebels of the lowest resistance army, the LRA, in northern Nigeria. Victims and perpetrators of violence dating back to 1987 now live side by side, although not always easy. Sergino Rusbla reports for VOA from Gulu.
Florence Ayot sweeps the ground in front of her hut. She lives here with her two children, children she had with Dominic Ongwen, a former senior commander of the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA. In January, Ongwen was captured and sent to The Hague, where he faces 67 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Florence says, "It hurts me to know that Dominic did not receive amnesty." She says she, Dominic, and many others were abducted by the LRA as children. Florence was taken in 1989. She was 9 years old. In 2005, she managed to escape and received amnesty. She says, "People talk about me behind my back. My children get picked on in schools." She says, "I have explained to my children what their father did and why he's not with us. I don't have a lot of money," she adds, "so sometimes I can't pay for school fees." There's a continued debate in Uganda. What to do about the thousands of children who were conscripted by the rebel group? Archbishop of Gulu, John Baptist Odama, was part of the efforts to negotiate a peace deal with the LRA in 2006.
Some families were torn apart. Some clans were torn apart. And the population was in pieces, we could say. Those who were there, some of them were not really by will. They were taken by force. So the people felt we must restore our relations back by forgiveness, including Konji himself. So let the society of Acholi be restored.
Today, Gulu is a beehive of activity, with people going to work, roads being constructed, and music playing on every street corner. The wounds of the now 30-year-old war can be quite difficult to see, but they are there.
I lost so many relatives. I lost my father in the war as well. So to me, this left a very big gap in my life.
Ivan Rachai supports amnesty.
We need to build our society. That's why we're not really bothered about creating more grudge. We are more of, you know, solving problems. I feel that that's the only way that we can resolve a conflict.
But for many here, forgiveness is just the first challenge. Serginho Rosblatt for VOA News, Gulu, Uganda.
Watch out, America. South Africa's most famous comedian has landed as the new host of The Daily Show. But was Trevor Noah's debut a splash or a belly flop? From Austin, Texas, VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell asked Americans what they think of Africa's favorite comedian.
Trevor Noah's Monday debut as host of the wildly popular American news parody The Daily Show has caused ripples on both sides of the Atlantic, with South Africa's foreign minister taking time out of her schedule at the United Nations General Assembly to visit the comedian in his New York studio. In his native South Africa, the popular comedian was widely hailed as brilliant, earning praise on social media from people as diverse as comedians, the nation's sports minister, to the national rugby team. But on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, Americans described his debut with an American word that needs no translation: meh. In fact, in the youth mecca of Austin, Texas, VOA News found exactly one person from among dozens we approached who actually watched the show on Monday night. And that one person does it for a living. Omar Gayaga is a technology and culture critic for the Austin American Statesman, the largest newspaper in the state capital. We sat down with him the morning after.
Like, I really don't feel, based on the first episode, that it was much different than The Daily Show under Jon Stewart. The writing felt very similar. I mean, there was one new correspondent, but the other correspondent bit felt like something right out of the Jon Stewart Daily Show era. And except for that it's a different guy, I mean, to me it felt very much like a substitute teacher trying to hype everybody up over the same lesson plan.
Noah, who is 31, was touted as the younger, cooler version of Stewart, who grew progressively more ornery and gnarled during his 16-year tenure. Noah underscored this point by referring to Stewart as Dad during his opening monologue. But it appears the new dad, Noah, will have to try to win America's youth, many of whom said they just did not watch the show. Justin Huebner, a 28-year-old bicycle taxi operator, took pity on this exasperated reporter and patiently slowly explain this phenomenon.
I think because a lot of people don't watch TV anymore, at least a lot of younger people don't watch TV or don't have cable.
But I ask Gayaga, is it possible that Noah's sharp wit, which to this reporter's ear hit all the right notes and made some cutting observations about the harsh reality of the world and the United States, was lost in translation? He answered by using another Americanism. The debut show was not, he said, a home run. That, he explained, is a baseball metaphor.
The guy with the bat hits the ball, it goes out past, you know, the fence, and that's a home run.
And they run in circles?
They go around the bases. It's a diamond. So there's first base, second base, third base, home base.
Wouldn't it be easier to just run back and forth and then, like, be more civilized and maybe stop for tea in the middle and, you know?
That sounds a lot like cricket.
It's clear that Noah, a fixture of the South African comedy scene, will need time in the anchor's chair to learn how to speak to his new American audience. Or maybe, with luck and hard work, he'll teach the world a new language, one that will make us all laugh. Anita Powell, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Defending champions Angola dismissed Gabon 57-44 in the quarterfinals of the Africa Women's Basketball Championships in Yaoundé, Cameroon on Thursday. In other quarterfinals, Cameroon outplayed Egypt 76-54, Senegal beat Mali 57-38, while Nigeria edged Mozambique 71-66. Today, Friday, Nigeria encounter Cameroon as Angola engaged Senegal in the semifinals. Turning to football, Algeria's Desert Fox are Africa's highest-ranked national men's football team, FIFA disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland, on Thursday. Algeria is 19th, while African champions Ivory Coast are 21st on the world rankings. Ghana is 25th, Tunisia 36th, Senegal 38th, Cape Verde Islands are 41st, Cameroon 48th, Republic of Congo 49th, Egypt 51st, and Nigeria 52nd. Meanwhile, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe hosts Sudan's El Merrekh in the return leg of their Orange Africa Champions League semifinals in Lubumbashi tomorrow, Saturday, while Algeria's USM Algiers are at home to Sudan's El Hilal in Algiers in the other semifinal. Elsewhere, Egyptian defending champions El Ahly host South Africa's Orlando Pirates in Cairo in the return leg of their Orange Africa Confederations Cup semifinals. Egypt's Zamalek welcomed Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel in the other semifinal. In Senegal, the West Africa Football Union WAFU Zone A Under-20 Championship starts in St. Louis, Senegal, tomorrow, Saturday. The week-long contest features Cape Verde Islands, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Liberia, Mali, Mauritania, Sierra Leone, and hosts Senegal. Moving on to rugby, South Africa plays Scotland at the Rugby World Cup in England tomorrow, Saturday. Victory for South Africa will bring them a step closer to the knockout phase of the competition. Finally, the two-day Safari Rugby Sevens tournament starts in Nairobi, Kenya tomorrow, Saturday. Italy, Namibia, Portugal, Spain, Uganda, Zambia, Zimbabwe, as well as club sides from England are among the main contenders challenging the Kenyan title defense. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. And we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The general behind last month's failed coup in Burkina Faso has surrendered to the country's transitional government. That's it for this Friday, October 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk. Turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing Turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on BOA Africa. Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa.